Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session, pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two causes on oral submission. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. First, Ross J. Boyer, doing business as the Ross Group, versus Laszlo M. Tauber and others, a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. And second, the Honorable Michael O'Connor, Justice, versus the First Court of Appeals, an original mandamus proceeding. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument. The appellant and relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal argument if they so advise the marshal of our court. We will take a recess in between the presentation of each argument and will complete both arguments, obviously, before the noon recess. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If anyone desires to listen to a tape of the oral argument, you may make application with our clerk to do so. The court is now ready to hear from Appellant and Boyer versus Tauber.
May it please the court, Mr. Lanny Vickery will present argument for appellant. Appellant has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Before you begin, on behalf of the court, wish to make a statement about the various motions that have been made to supplement or strike the briefing that has been sent to us. The court, pursuant to Rule 114, will consider only those factual matters certified to us by the Fourth Circuit. We will carry all of these motions along with the case, but we are not going to consider or in any way regard anything that we do not believe is factually contained within the agreed stipulation of facts sent to us. If anyone desires to put more facts before the court, we respectfully request that you go to the Fourth Circuit, work out a new stipulation, and have those facts sent to us. So please confine yourself in the argument to those matters in the stipulation.
May it please the court. My name is Lanny Vickery. I'm the firm of Vickery, Kilbride, Gilmore, and Vickery, and I represent the petitioner, Ross Boyer, in this case. Today, the court considers two certified questions, one of evidence, one of equity. In December of 1988, Dr. Laszlo Tauber purchased an office building in Nashville, Tennessee for $17 million. In April of 1988, Dr. Tauber had written a letter to the seller of that property in which, among other things, he acknowledged that he was responsible to pay a percent and a half commission, or $255,000, to, quote, outside brokers, comma, including Dr. Julian Pars.
Which he paid. Did he pay it?
No, Your Honor, he did not.
Didn't pay any of that?
No, Your Honor, what I was just about to tell you is that according to his own testimony, Dr. Tauber paid no commissions at all. What he did pay was a little in excess of $168,000 as a finder's fee.
What's the difference?
Your Honor, in this case, there are two differences. One, the commission versus the finder's fee, when it's the person, the obligor, who's making that distinction, especially in a case like this where it's admitted in the stipulated statement of facts that the finder with whom Dr. Tauber was dealing was representing himself to be his equity partner. It is significant whether he's going to say that he paid the commission to discharge his obligation or whether he didn't. He says he didn't. Yes, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
Now, I was going to say, furthermore, it's undisputed that of his promise to pay a full $255,000, he has only paid $168,000.
Plus closing costs.
Your Honor, his promise was to pay a $255,000 commission.
He says that the cost were to come out of that amount.
Your Honor, that's not what he said in his writing at all. The writing that we're concerned with today says only $255,000 commission.
These numbers are contained on page 3 of your brief. And in looking at the brief, when was the first time that your client dealt directly with adoption.
The first time...
Does that matter that within the stipulation or not within the stipulation?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. It's the first time that he dealt with Dr. Tauber was after the closing. All along before that, he had been dealing with Mr. Pars, who had represented that he spoke for Dr. Tauber.
Now, you say in your brief that you've been unable to serve Mr. Pars, and you refer to him as Dr. Pars. Is he a medical doctor?
No, Your Honor. Dr. quote-unquote Pars represented himself to have a Ph.D. from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and I believe that everyone in this case would stipulate now that he is not, in fact, a doctor and never was. Okay. It is undisputed in this case that Ross Boyer was the procuring cause of this sale. It is undisputed in this case that Ross Boyer was the outside broker of whom Dr. Tauber wrote. As the stipulated statement of facts reflects...
Well, he couldn't have been the only one, could he? Because he said including Dr. Pars.
Well, yes, sir. The phrase was outside brokers, including Dr. Pars. So you're right. The outside brokers were Ross Boyer and Mr. Pars.
And to allow parole evidence to explain outside brokers would allow any broker claiming to have procured or been a partial reason for procuring a sale to claim an interest in the 1.5% commission, would it not?
Only if the person who promised to pay that commission backed him up, Your Honor. The whole purpose of the parole evidence rule is to explain an ambiguous term. So the only party who can logically testify to what he meant by an ambiguous term is if it's an agreement, all the parties who were signatories to the agreement, and in this case, since it's a letter, only Dr. Tauber.
So only if Dr. Tauber backed up the broker who claimed commission, could it be payable to that, could that be admissible?
That's our position, Your Honor.
And here, Dr. Tauber does not back up your client's claim to be an outside broker, does he?
Yes, Your Honor, he does. Dr. Tauber admits that the outside broker to whom he had reference was whoever that broker was that was working with Julian Pars.
By name?
No, he did not know his name, Your Honor. That's the whole problem that has given rise to the certified question. If he had known his name, I'm quite sure he would have written his name. But he didn't know his name.
What portion of the commission did Dr. Tauber agree to pay Mr. Boyer, and what portion Mr. Pars?
Your Honor, he did not split it up. He agreed to pay a $255,000 commission, and he said he paid no commission. He paid only a finder's fee.
Well, if it turns out to be impossible to distinguish between a commission and a finder's fee, then Mr. Boyer would only be due whatever Mr. Tauber chose to give him under the agreement.
Your Honor, our position is that Mr. Boyer is due the commission. He was the broker in the case. He was due the commission of $255,000.
The agreement says brokers including Pars, so if he pays
right
all but a dollar of it to Pars and gives Mr. Boyer the dollar, does that satisfy the obligation?
Your Honor, if indeed Dr. Tauber had paid the full commission in this case, if he said, I owe a $255,000 commission, I have paid $255,000 as a commission, I wouldn't have the privilege of standing here today. I wouldn't have the case.
If you paid it all to Pars, you'd go home.
If you paid it all to Pars, I'd have to go home, Your Honor. And that is another important fact that's in front of the court today. The man acknowledged his responsibility to pay a commission of $255,000. And he only paid $168,000, and he denied that was a commission. Said it was just a finder's fee.
What is the policy of the statute in question before the court?
Your Honor, according to the legislative history that I was able to find, the policy is primarily to prevent fraudulent claims by unqualified, unscrupulous brokers. And I believe if you look at the content of the Act and of the legislative history as it was passed, the vast majority of the Act addresses that evil by training requirements, licensing requirements. In 1975, the legislature established a real estate recovery fund, and that type of thing. There is, as I was saying, it is undisputed that Ross Boyer is entitled to a commission under Texas law. The only questions are whether or not he can introduce enough evidence or whether equity will provide him the means to get the commission that he's due. In determining the legislative intent, and as I did in my brief, I'm going to take the questions in reverse order. First of all, can you, the question that, if the evidentiary question, can you introduce parole evidence to explain an ambiguous term? In, as with any statute, this court must interpret the statute along the mandates of Government Code Section 312.006A, which provides that the revised statutes are the law of this state and shall be liberally construed to achieve their purpose and to promote justice. It is sometimes a difficult task when you have an old law and a changing world to continue to use the statute to ascertain both legislative intent and to make it flexible enough to make it a useful statute. In this case, the court has just that opportunity. The Real Estate Licensing Act is over 50 years old now. This court, in that history, has interpreted it really not that often at all, and the most recent that I know of being the Givens case back in 1984. Usually, the name of the broker is going to be something that's going to be in a commission agreement. I mean, it's going to be named because, in general, principals and their brokers deal face-to-face. But in this case, we have a real estate operation of a totally different magnitude. Have an individual who buys multi-million dollar buildings, individual who's very busy and who therefore uses finders to kind of do the initial screening of the buildings that he wants to buy. And it does no harm to the policy of the Real Estate License Act, and indeed it is the only just result that in a case such as this, where you have a man such as Dr. Tauber, who's using a finder and who knows that there is a broker involved, but doesn't know his name because he doesn't know it, that you should be able to, when he writes a letter and says that we're responsible to pay commissions to outside brokers, including Dr. Julian Pars, that we should be able to introduce parole evidence to show who the outside brokers are.
And if you can use parole evidence to show that, can you use it to show what the commission was, what the amount of commission agreed upon was?
Your Honor, I don't think I need it. In this case.
No, I'm saying how far does this rule go? If it were permissible to show the name of the broker, could you use parole evidence to show the amount of commission agreed upon?
Your Honor, that would depend on the facts, but I would say that in general this court has addressed that issue in the Girardi case.
Yes, and said no.
And said, right, that the usual
commission. How is this different?
Because, Your Honor, this is a case that involves the identification requirement of the broker. Why should it be any different? Tough to say, but the decisions of this court and of the Texas courts have had different standards for different requirements.
If this agreement said Tauber agrees to pay a commission to Boyer, period, it named him, but it didn't set the amount of the commission.
And it had no ambiguity whatsoever?
Well, it's ambiguous, and you're going to argue to us that it's ambiguous because he agreed to pay some commission, it just didn't say how much. So you should be able to introduce parole evidence to show how much.
No, Your Honor, the scenario that you just put forth has no ambiguity in terms of what the commission might be. Some commission, in my mind anyway, is not ambiguous, such as to justify parole evidence.
The usual commission.
The usual commission has been the subject of the Girardi case.
And so what's the difference?
So the difference is that in the Girardi case, the court addressed the problems of commissions, of the usual commission, and it said that the usual commission is not good enough.
I realize that. What's the difference between that case and this case?
Your Honor, the difference between that case and this case is that one involved the amount of commission, this one involved the identification of the broker. And should there be a difference? I don't know. I can't answer that question for you. Is there a difference in the way that this court has treated various requirements in terms of allowing parole evidence? Yes, sir, there is.
Well, and when have we allowed parole evidence to get around the statute?
Parole evidence has been allowed to get around the statute in a number of cases. One, the Parker versus Uthier case, which is a 1948 case. In that case, there was a fully executed writing that met the requirements of the Real Estate Licensing Act. The principal refused to pay the broker, The broker filed suit against him. The principal said, wait a minute, the sale's never closed. And the broker was, the commission was never due until the sale closed, although that wasn't in the agreement. The trial judge submitted it to the jury. The jury found that there was an oral agreement. The trial judge rendered judgment for the seller. It went up to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals said, wait a minute, you can't allow oral evidence in. You can't allow this parole evidence in. This court and the Court of Appeals reversed the judgment of the trial court. This court said, look, in this case, the oral agreement does not supply any term that is inconsistent with the terms that are in the writing. Therefore, we're going to let that oral agreement in.
Here the letter that Dr. Tauber sent contemplated more than one outside broker, did it not?
Yes, Your Honor, it did.
And you said earlier that if he had paid the 1.5% commission to Mr. Pars, that you wouldn't be here.
Right, Your Honor.
So can parole evidence supply the split of the commission between more than one broker?
As against the principal, Your Honor, I don't believe it can.
Well, if he and in fact paid the, whatever it is, $165,000 to Mr. Pars, and your client would be entitled to the remainder, is parole evidence admissible to show that division of the commission?
If he had said that the $168,000 plus was a commission, then I believe parole evidence would be admissible to show that the difference went to that, if you even needed it. I mean, the way that I would interpret that situation is if he said he's going to pay a total commission of $255,000, paid $168,000, as said that's a commission, then what's left is $87,000 as a commission. Another case, to answer your question, Justice Hecht, is the longstanding line of cases that began with the Pickett v. Bishop case and perhaps the most strongly stated in the Kmeck v. Reagan case, both of which were decided by this court, in which the court has held that if property is identified as my property, then you can combine that with parole evidence to show that my property, if it's my property in Robertson County, say, well, this is all the property I own in Robertson County. Certainly the phrase my property is ambiguous.
Was there anything in the stipulated record that showed why your client took no action to protect his interest, got no agreement in writing with respect to commissions, what percentages, anything to protect his interest?
Your Honor, it's implicit in the stipulated statement of facts that it was trust. It was just blind trust. That's not specifically stated, but that's what it was, and I think if you fairly read the stipulated statement of facts, that's what jumps out.
Any other questions at this time? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from appellees.
May it please the court. Mr. Melvin Dow will present argument for appellee.
May it please the court, my name is Melvin Dow. I'm from the firm of Dow, Cochran & Friedman in Houston, Texas. We represent respondent Laszlo Tauber. There are two other respondents in the case. We do not represent Dr. Pars. We do not represent Consolidated Financial Trust. I have delivered to the court this morning an outline of our oral argument. It makes reference to the magistrate's report. Based on the comments of the Chief Justice, I will not be referring to the magistrate's report in my oral argument. I will generally otherwise follow the outline of my oral argument as the court has before it. First, as a threshold point, it is the position of the respondent that the Texas Real Estate License Act has for its purpose creating certainty and specificity with respect to brokerage contracts under which a broker seeks to collect a commission for a real estate transaction. The statute requires a writing for an agreement or a promise, or that there be a memorandum of the writing of the agreement or promise. In this case, we think there is no agreement. Agreement means a meeting of the minds. In this case, there was no contact of the mines between the petitioner Boyert and the respondent Taubert. Boyert never talked to Taubert before the transaction, never wrote to him, never communicated with him, never had any form of agreement with him at all. There was no contact of the mines, much less a meeting of the mines. Boyert had contact with this intermediate Pars, as did Taubert. But Pars had no authority to speak for Taubert. Taubert had agreements with Pars. Presumably Boyert had agreement with Pars. But they never had any agreement with each other. And the chronology of events is significant. Taubert wrote a letter on April 15, 1988. Prior to that time, Boyert had already done everything he was going to do. He received some material relating to this building from another broker, and he presumably forwarded that package to Pars. And that was done in March of 88. It was not until April 15th of 88 that Taubert wrote the letter. The only writing to which Boyert can refer is a letter written by Taubert, not written to Boyert, but written to the seller of the property, and written after Boyert had done everything that he claims he had done.
So if Mr. Boyert's name had been mentioned in the letter, would that have made any difference?
I think that probably would have made a difference, Your Honor.
Represented a meeting of the minds.
No, I think that's correct. If there had been some prior agreement, or if the transaction had been completed before that, and there had been the mention of the name, I think that would have made some difference. I further think that it would have been necessary for the agreement to indicate how the commission was to be divided, because I think there are four essential elements that the statute requires, and these are referred to in the Levinson case and also in the Knight case. The four essential elements are that there be an agreement in writing, number one. Number two, that it name the broker. Number three, that it state what is the amount of the commission that's to be paid. And number four, that it describe the property within the parameters of what's an adequate legal description. So I think naming the broker would have overcome one of the four if it had named Ross Boyert. I think it would have been necessary further to indicate how the commission was going to be divided between Pars and Boyert.
Do you concede that this court has eased or has interpreted your fourth and final requirement somewhat more liberally in favor of the broker than it would have had to do under the terms of the statute?
The matter of legal description,
yes.
Your Honor? I would say there are differences with respect to the legal description. The My Property cases, including the Kmese case and the Pickett case to which the petitioner referred, do not really require oral testimony. They require extrinsic, but not oral, because both the holding of both of those cases is that when you refer to My Property, if it is the only property that the My owns within a particular county, then the reference is not to the uncertainty of oral conversations. The reference is to the deed records, because you can look in the deed records and see My Property means thus and so, or in Harris County we call it the Official Public Records of Real Property. But in every county there are records to which there can be a reference. So I would say to that extent there's been some relaxation, but it gets you to writings, not to conversations.
But the seller could claim that in My Property he was not intending to sell all of the track, but maybe only the half of the track he lived on. So, I mean, there still could be problems. Once the court relaxes the requirements to that extent, you lose the certainty, the summary judgment inevitability of one of these types of cases.
I agree with that. I think that if the hypothetical case were I agreed to sell a portion of my property, the statute would strike it down. I think if it said I agree to sell the entirety of my property, I think that's valid under the statute.
Counsel, in the letter of April 1988, which refers to 1.5% commission or $255,000, your client did pay a finder's fee of $168,000. But if you add the finder's fee to the closing cost, coincidentally, they come up to exactly to the penny, $255,000. is it your position that a finder's fee is the same as the commission?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. I think there's no difference, and I don't know why Dr. Talbert, his deposition apparently attempted to make some difference in terminology. I think there's no difference, and moreover, I think that in other numerous cases before this court, there have been many attempts by very creative lawyers to give what was essentially compensation for acting as an intermediary in a real estate transaction some other name. They've attempted to call it finder's fee. They've attempted to call it quantum merit compensation. There's a case in which the broker was a lawyer and also an engineer, and he decided that while the services had been brokerage services, he called it legal fees and engineering fees. I think whether it's called finder's fee, commission, if it is compensation for essentially a broker's activity of being the intermediary in a transaction, I think there's no difference. The petitioner has made some reference to the equities of the situation and the extent of the services. Sticking to the record, let me say that there is nothing in the record that indicates the nature or extent of Boyard's services. Boyard is referred to as an outside broker, meaning that there was an inside broker. Typically, the inside broker would have prepared a brochure, would have assembled a description of the property, details as to the leases, financial information as to the cash flow generated by the property, have done all this work, and for all we know from the record, there was a brochure received by Boyard from the inside broker forwarded to PARS. And that might have been the only thing that he had to do in this transaction. Now, that puts him in the link, in the causal link, but there would have been the inside broker, Boyard, and Julian PARS all cooperating to pass this information on to Dr. Talbert. But I think that that from this record, it takes a gigantic leap to think that there was any kind of extensive services performed by Boyard.
One of the problems that we have on these certified question cases is the limited nature of the record. And while we have said this morning that we're not looking at the magistrate's report, in the event that you are opposing counsel, ask the Fourth Circuit to supplement the record. Please advise our court by copy if you make such a request, and likewise, if the record is supplemented and either of you feel that affects the terms of the question that has been certified to us, advise us whether you've asked the Fourth Circuit to amend their question.
I will do that, Your Honor. At this point, all I was referring to, there is some material in the magistrate's report that I would love to refer to where I'm free to do so. I attempted to reason only from the term outside broker. May I turn to section 2 of our brief, which deals with certified question number 1, partial performance. We have listed a baker's dozen of 13 cases in which partial performance has been held not sufficient to take the transaction out of the statute. It seems to us that the rationale of these cases is clear and is stated, as a matter of fact, in the Carmack case, which is cited by the petitioner, and that is, if partial performance took these brokerage cases outside the statute, then there would be no statute. Because every time a broker is suing for a commission or is seeking a commission, it is because there has been a transaction which has closed. If there were no transaction that had closed, or if he had not found a purchaser ready, willing, and able, then there would be no plausible claim for commission. So every time there's a claim for a commission, there has been partial performance. We cite the Tidwell case, a 1954 case of this court, which dealt with an inadequate description in the brokerage agreement. The transaction closed. The deed was delivered. It was acknowledged that the deed conveyed the same property that was inartfully referred to in the earnest money contract, and this court held that partial performance, or really full performance, it's referred to in that case as a fully executed contract, did not obviate the statute. And the language is stated very, very forcefully in the Bryce case, which we cite. That case on page 57 says, we find no cases applying the doctrine of part performance to defeat the statute of frauds for real estate commissions. The equitable justifications are not present in the context of brokers and salesmen licensed to practice real estate. knowledge of the necessity of a written agreement in order to bring an action in court to collect a real estate commission can be imputed to such individuals. So we think the rationale is well stated and there is clear case authority. I will not describe the other 13 cases that we have listed there. I will merely emphasize the Tidwell case, the 1954 case decided by this court, and I would urge the petitioner in his rebuttal to tell us how this court could possibly decide certified question number one in the affirmative without overruling the Tidwell case, which you decided in 1954. The petitioner cites the Carmack case as being a case which they claim upholds the concept of partial performance. That case is very easily distinguished on its facts. The facts are that the broker initially had an agreement to find a tenant. He did find a tenant. The brokerage agreement was imprecise as to the description of the property. The owner who owned the property and who entered the brokerage agreement actually signed a lease with the tenant. Tenant moved into the building, and at that moved into the building and began to pay rent and paved two vacant lots as parking area. The owner then, after the tenant had moved in and after the lease was signed, signed another agreement with the broker acknowledging that he owed him a commission, paid half the commission, and acknowledged that he owed him a commission, the remaining half the commission, for a transaction that was already completed. Services were fully performed. So that was really not an agreement in advance, an executory agreement to pay a commission. It was an acknowledgement that a commission was due for services completed. And the Carmack case is cited and discussed extensively on page 28 of our brief. And moreover, that case points out its own limitations. It says that essentially that it's limited to its facts where the issue is an inadequate description, and then it gives four qualifications. The broker's performed, the owner knowingly accepted the services, the other party has acknowledged in writing his obligation for commission, and the sequence of events shows that, as the facts of the case show, that the acknowledgement was after the performance of the services. It goes on to say that another requirement is that there be documentary evidence to establish the amount of the commission, and as this court has pointed out in questions directed previously, the amount of the commission here, any division as between Pars and Boyer, is simply not set out in the agreement. The case also says that a broker stands in a different position with respect to part performance because he does not take possession or make improvements to property. Allowing a broker to recover on the grounds of his performance alone would permit enforcement of any commission agreement fully performed by the broker. In other words, the Carmack case is saying our decision is limited. You cannot take it beyond the facts of this case because if you do, you completely gut the statute. In our oral argument outline, we point out that the cases involving contracts to convey, which do make reliance on partial performance, are different for a number of reasons. Those cases basically hold that if three requirements are present, that the buyer has paid consideration, which the seller has accepted, that the buyer has taken possession of the property with the knowledge of the seller, and that the buyer has made valuable improvements to the property with the knowledge of the seller, then in the contract to convey cases, which are different from the brokerage cases, those events take, that kind of partial performance takes the case out of the statute. The reason is that the corroborative effect of those facts makes it entirely different. Obviously, a seller of land is not taking money from the buyer, letting the buyer take possession, letting the buyer make improvements, unless he thinks there is some agreement. On the other hand, Dr. Talbert could have closed this transaction without having recognized any agreement on his part to pay Boyer anything. So there is no corroborative effect to any allegation of an agreement based on the fact that Dr. Talbert and others closed the deal.
If we should answer certified question number one, as you have advised, would there be any reason for us to decline perhaps to answer question number two?
I think it would be unnecessary, Your Honor. I think that for the petitioner to prevail, he would have to prevail on both.
As relates to question number two, which I expect from your outline you're about to get to in these remaining minutes,
right.
Let me ask you whether or not we could rely on parole evidence if this letter had simply said, in addition to Parr, Smith,
and there were two dozen Smiths who handled real estate in the area.
I think you could not, Your Honor.
First name?
I think you could not. I think there would have to be enough specificity to the name so that from that writing he could be identified. I'm not sure what would happen if you got a first name and a middle initial. Taking me down that trail, I'm going to tell you at that point I don't know the answer.
It is the kind of thing that's inclined to work an extremely inequitable result, isn't it?
I think it has that potential. Of course, we don't have John Q. Smith here. We have outside broker, and I would say the court should limit the John Q. Smith case until that one comes before the court, in the tradition of the common law of not deciding any more than we really have to. The certified question number two is whether parole evidence can supply the name of the broker. There are at least four cases that say it cannot. Knight versus, and I suppose I should indicate that the cases all say that there are certain essential terms or essential elements that must be contained in the writing. And I mentioned it briefly before, the basic agreement must be in writing and signed by the party to be charged. It must name the broker involved. It must stipulate the amount of the commission. That's number three. And it must describe the property. That's number four. The Wasson versus Hart case referred to and your associates, which we think is somewhat similar to outside brokers. It was held that that parole evidence was not permitted to fill in who the associates were. The petitioner's brief indicates some puzzlement as to how you identify the broker. I'm puzzled at the puzzlement because the cases say all you have to do is give his name. In the Watson versus Brazelton case, one party said, you're to pay 5% commission on $9,000, I'm to pay $5,000 commission on $5,000. They each knew who the broker was, the broker had done his job, but the broker's name was not there. And the courts have construed the statute strictly to say you must name the broker. I believe that the cases dealing with any of the essential elements are all on a parity. If the case says usual commission, which is one, and the commission is one of the essential elements, you cannot determine usual commission without parole evidence. And I think that the Buratti case is in saying that parole evidence is not admitted to fill in that essential element supports the contention of the respondents that you cannot use parole evidence to fill in the name of the broker. The Buratti case is a 1949 Supreme Court case. I really think that it would be difficult for this court to answer certified question number two in the affirmative without overruling Buratti. There is a further Supreme Court case, the Wilson case, decided by this court in 1945, dealing with the property description by street address, and the court held that that was not a sufficient legal description and prohibited parole evidence to fill in the essential ingredient there. Again, we're dealing with two, what the courts have classified as essential terms, the property description, the name of the broker, and the amount of the commission. There are Supreme Court cases dealing with two out of those three, dealing with the commission, dealing with the identity of the property. In both cases, the Supreme Court has refused to permit parole evidence to explain. And I think that dealing with this other element, the name of the broker, the same rule should apply.
Expired, yes. Somebody has a question.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Just a few closing comments in response to respondents' comments. One says that four Texas cases have addressed this issue before. No Texas case has ever addressed this issue before. Four cases have said that the name of the broker is a required element, but the name of the broker, the proper identification, was not at issue in any of those cases, and I believe I've adequately discussed that in my opening remarks. If I haven't, I welcome any questions. They begin saying that there was no agreement here, that the basis of the statute is an agreement, but if you read Section 20B, it says an agreement or a promise to pay a commission. In this case, in March of 1988, Ross Boyer found the property, forwarded the information to on the property to Mr. Parr, and in April, 1 month later, Dr. Tauber writes a letter back and promises to pay the exact same commission that Ross Boyer had specified to outside brokers, including Dr. Julian Parr.
Say a letter back, you mean to the purchaser? A letter back, you mean to the seller?
Yes, Your Honor, a letter to the seller, April letter. There was also some discussion about the difference between a commission and a finder's fee, and Mr. Dow made reference to cases that have held that it doesn't matter what you call it. Those cases were all cases in which someone was trying to get a fee, and for one reason or another, either they weren't a licensed broker or they did not have a writing which complied with the statute, they were trying to say, well, this isn't really a real estate commission, this is really a finder's fee, and trying to take it out of the statute. In those cases, the courts have quite rightly held that, wait a minute, you can't call this by something else. You can't disguise a real estate commission as something else just and thereby escape the requirements of the Real Estate Licensing Act. In this case, it's not the broker who's playing fast and loose with the names. It's Dr. Tauber who himself said, wait a minute, I didn't pay a commission. I paid a finder's fee. And I posit to you that the reason that he didn't is because supposed Dr. Parr's was not a broker. He couldn't take his commission. Finally, there were comments about partial performance. Dr. Tauber's attorneys have classified our position as being that whenever a broker is the procuring cause of a transaction and that transaction closes, then partial performance can excuse compliance with the Real Estate Licensing Act. That isn't our position at all. Our position is that if the broker is the procuring cause and the deal closes and the statutory requirements are complied with, i.e. there is a writing which evidences an agreement that is signed by the obligor, that in that particular case, if for some reason the writing does not meet a technical requirement of the Real Estate Licensing Act, a judicial requirement, then in that case you can attempt to take it out of the strict workings of the Real Estate Licensing Act by applying the doctrine of partial performance. But in any case, you have to have a writing. You have to comply with the statutory requirements that there be a writing signed by the purchaser.
So is partial performance really irrelevant to your argument?
No, Your Honor. It's not.
You'll always have an element of partial performance in every single one of these cases, or else the broker wouldn't be claiming the fee, I suppose.
Well, Your Honor, as I understand what Dr. Tauber has argued, they've argued that any time you have an oral agreement, just a purely oral agreement, if in fact the broker was the procuring cause and the sale closed, that we would argue that partial performance takes it out of the Real Estate Licensing Act. What I'm saying is that an oral agreement by itself won't do it. The partial performance doctrine is designed to prevent an inequity. I don't think that it's ever been the purpose of the Real Estate Licensing Act to prevent fraud on the principal by promoting fraud on the broker. And that's exactly what would happen in a case like this.
Well, to preclude promoting fraud on the broker, all the broker has to do is get an agreement, doesn't it?
Your Honor, that is true. And in 95% of the cases, the broker probably does have an agreement.
And the purpose of this statute is to avoid cases just like this one.
Your Honor, I don't believe that's true at all. otherwise, the statute could have provided that the agreement or promise itself has to be in writing. The statute doesn't provide that. The statute says the agreement or promise or some memorandum thereof. It's clear from the Stewart versus Coldwell Banker case. And I believe that's the only one that's off the top of my head.
Coming in.
Just one more question. Do you agree with the opposing counsel that in the event that the first question is answered adversely to you, there's no need for this court to reach the second?
Your Honor, I think that I would have to pretty much agree with him. The problem is that the questions are really in reverse order. Question two really should be considered first, and both parties have briefed them in that order, I think, realizing that's the situation.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.
Thank you.